During my last year of high school, I just couldn't wait to join the Army because my father, my stepfather, was already in North Africa with the Army, so my mother reluctantly agreed to let me enlist. And the airborne at that time was the newest thing on the block, so I became a paratrooper. Went to Fort Benning and ended up being assigned to the 551st Parachute Infantry Battalion.
Exotic stuff for World War II.
16 year old.
16, huh?
Yeah.
Did you lie about your age?
Yeah. Then the Korean War broke out, and in arriving at the port of embarkation, they had every former World War II combat infantryman earmarked to fly to Korea. The non-combat experience went by boat. The rest of us were flown over.
And were you with the 82nd?
No, I was as an individual replacement. And by that time, I'd been commissioned a second lieutenant.
Okay.
And again, kind of like the Phoenix program, they were fleshing out a partisan infantry organization to operate behind the lines in North Korea.
Who is just the MacArthur's staff?
General MacArthur's headquarters.
Okay.
And I was ended up being assigned to that. And I trained and delivered partisan infantry types in rear of the front line as far north as the Yalu River.
So these are Koreans you're training?
Koreans. And as a result of having been in the 8240th Army Unit in Korea, I received a letter from the Assistant Chief of Staff for Intelligence Office, Army, asking if I would like to join an Army sensitive intelligence program. And I did, and I spent two tours in Germany in that activity. I came back to Fort Bragg and became the deputy commander of the Continental Army Command Intelligence Center. And our main mission at that time was to support 18th Airborne Corps on their worldwide immediate response mission, and also train and deploy Army intelligence units to Vietnam. And during the period that I was there, we activated and deployed practically every Army intelligence unit that went to Vietnam. While I was there, I also activated and commanded the 14th MI Battalion and the 48th Military Intelligence Group that essentially reconstituted the STRAC forces in the United States.
And that stands for STRAC?
Strategic Army Reserve Corps. And from there, I went to Vietnam and was assigned as the Phoenix coordinator for 4th Corps. You're reporting to the CA's ROIC, a regional officer in charge.
Okay.
MI Branch called me at Fort Bragg and said, so we've alerted you to go to Vietnam as the G2 of the 101st Airborne Division. Branch then called me and said, you're not going with the 101st, but we got what we consider critical requirements. And we can't discuss it over the phone. It's classified, and you'll find out when you get there, but we're giving you very short notice. Those were very high requirements. They had specifically brought in four very experienced experienced officers at the lieutenant colonel level to go into each of the regions. And but having been already in two major conflicts, my own feeling was that the year's going to pass a hell of a lot faster if you're out daily pursuing the war than back in Saigon writing about it. I was briefed by the staff that I would essentially be the ROIC's senior advisor and coordinator on the Phoenix program in the Delta. And at that point in time, I was given a very brief outline of what the program was all about, which is really essentially an intensified, coordinated effort to get every U.S. and allied and South Vietnamese entity coordinated and directed towards the infrastructure. I felt that at that point in time, the staff that they had was really not that field experienced to understand how the program was going to develop or evolve.
You had 3 days of processing, in which this briefing was part of that. You really didn't learn a lot from it because people weren't all that familiar themselves. They just told you that you're going to be working with Ward, and you're going to assist him on collecting and coordinating intelligence in the Delta.
That's right, and they really didn't have a good grasp for how it was going to evolve, because I think as the ISEX program, which was the forerunner of Phoenix, I think it must have been run pretty directly at the province level, principally with the agency running it. But this
That's
now,
exactly what happened.
And you see, a lot of people do not understand that when Mac V took over and fleshed out the Phoenix program with hundreds of military and money, it really was a joint effort then, and actually CIA was a supporter and a partial sponsor of it, but Mac V really had the con for it.
But that doesn't happen until later, right?
It evolves. They had come up with their conception of the region and the province and the district staff, where you'd put in an intelligence officer to do nothing but focus on the Phoenix program.
Yeah,
and that those people would be provided by the military.
Okay.
And I don't really remember the percentage, but there would be a percentage, and for all intents and purposes, it could have been 50% funding of the operational expenses by MACV to reimburse CIA. Because I remember I got called on the carpet in the Delta because I had spent an awful lot of money reimbursing CA for aircraft support, which up until that time I didn't even know we had to do that. In the protocol between the agency and MACV, there was a certain amount of financial reimbursement that MACV assumed to support operations. The Phoenix staff was located in the CA compound in Canton.
Right, okay.
There were, as I said, a lot of people that I think had come in from administrative positions in the building up of this program that had not been out on the ground running operations and realized that you cannot become so secretive that you can't even run an operation.
Right.
So I think that we did a tremendous amount of breakthrough in the Delta because we, yes, we were always aware of the need for seekers, so that where we suspected there was a leak, they would try to hold everything as close as possible, but sometimes you just couldn't do it, and you had to plan and coordinate and run the operation. That was Chowduck Province.
Okay.
I went up there on Sunday morning. It was my first introduction to the real war. And we landed there in the province town. And the
and this is right after Tet, so there must have still been stuff going on. Because
a lot of activity.
Yeah.
And the young sergeant there, Drew Dick.
He's in that article.
Drew, yeah. There had just been a, early that morning, in one of the little villages, the VC had come in and they gotten a couple out that were accused of collaborating with the government. And they'd shot them in the ears. And their bodies were lying out on a cart where the villagers had put them up. And we had the Jeep sandbag because they may have put mines in those dirt roads. And we drove out there. It was only a few minutes. I looked at that and all the natives standing around, and it's the first awareness of what those natives are up against.
Yeah.
Because during the night, that damn VC team had come in, they'd gotten all the villagers together and warned them about cooperating, and so we're going to, you know, present an example of what we do to collaborate with. And
yeah.
They shot them in the ear right on the spot. So yeah. I knew then what my job was.
What was your job? What did you then see at that moment as being your job?
I realized that there was a tremendous psychological problem to try and overcome in developing specifically that group of villagers to cooperate in a program, because to me, the Phoenix program was one of acquiring adequate and timely and detailed information so that we could intercept and either defect, kill, maim, or capture the Viet Cong and the guerrilla forces operating in our area. Phoenix people, our Army military intelligence officers, had begun to arrive in these staff positions, you know, one at district level and one at province. So and Conger gave me a few tips about the same problem, but number one, trying to get the different agencies to cooperate and trying to overcome the terrorist psychological problem that existed throughout the villages and hamlets. Something that did surface at that point in time is that there were many people around that felt, although they didn't know that much about what the Phoenix program was all about, that thought it was a threat to them,
like
in some
who?
Way. Yeah, you know, it's like a threat to your power base.
And are you talking mostly Vietnamese or Americans?
Both.
Okay.
Yeah, when you think about it, it's kind of in direct conflict to our culture. And I guess our experience over the years where we take a U.S. Army military element, whatever it may be, and direct it towards not only the military and the paramilitary enemy forces, but the civilians that cooperate with them.
Mm-hmm.
And really we're out to surface and either destroy or defect that infrastructure, as opposed to fighting a main force battle. And I think most of us that had been around a while, that was in the back of our mind that we were, a great amount of what we were doing, we're pursuing a campaign to destroy this illegal political apparatus that existed, the VC infrastructure.
But do you think that Phoenix might be somewhat responsible for changing military thinking?
I think it, if anything, exacerbated a problem we were faced with here in the United States, where the and the there's a basic conflict. What we were charged to do in Vietnam, when it was discovered that that was, I mean, you're not killing in doing anything of that sort in the United States. There was a domestic intelligence. Mm-hmm. Activity that Army intelligence was involved in, that the Church Committee got a lot of publicity in surfacing, and I think that if anything, it had a very bad effect on the particularly the Army's capability in providing counterintelligence support, and we're confronted with the problem today on terrorism. And what evolved out of this big expose of the Church Committee is that the military were prohibited from going after any targets that are not either DOD or DOD affiliated. And essentially, it shot the military out of any domestic intelligence activity and led to the activation of the Defense Investigative Service, which is a civilian-oriented organization, which is questionable in my mind that they are as effective as they could be, and I don't think they have the capacity to be effective at all in the event of a wartime situation developing.
I thought that the Defense Investigative Service was strictly doing background checks on people who work for military contractors and that kind of stuff.
Okay, well, that's analogous to what we were doing in Vietnam and trying to investigate and identify the infrastructure. In that case, we'd get the Vietnamese to go get them, or in those areas where they were inhibited, we would go get them.
Okay.
In the United States, you're doing the same thing, except you could, if it looked like a case where there's treason or
sedition,
it could be immediately referred to the FBI because the Army was not empowered to go out and arrest someone unless it was on a military post.